welcome to episode 4 of All Movie Talk, the greatest movie podcast in the universe. Today we'll be talking a bit about movie theaters, and then we'll have a trivia question where Steven makes a fool out of me. Following that, we'll continue our series about James Bond. Then we're going to have a new segment called the Film Buff's Dictionary, where we talk about some movie-related terms. Then our new top 6 list, which is all about movie adaptations of books or plays or whatever, where the movie version is more definitive and famous than the source material. Wrapping things up, we'll have a film spotlight on The Third Man, which is a great classic movie. I am Sam Stoddard.
And I'm Stephen Keller. And you know what I like more than movies, Sam?
What do you like more than movies? I can't imagine.
I like talking about movies more than I like movies.
Oh, I might too, actually. So let's do some of that.
There's a real problem with the kids today. As, you know, we like to point out from time to time, the kids are ungrateful. But the other problem with the kids, including Sam, who's actually older than I am, is they have no appreciation for seeing movies in the theater. And that brings us to today's installment of The Controversial Take, which one of us defends a position that's maybe not so popular. And today I'm going to defend a position that I think is increasingly unpopular, and that is movies are best seen in the movie theater, not at your home watching it on your little tiny 40-inch TV or whatever people use, this new technology that I don't understand. For a couple of reasons, I think they're better in the theater. First of all is that that's the way movies are meant to be seen, and they're not meant to be seen in a little box next to your couch. Another reason is I think you get more sense of the spectacle of film seen in a theater. And thirdly, I'm going to argue that it's actually cheaper for the relative quality. People like to complain about how expensive movies are, but I think if we do a little bit of math, it's not so crazy. Now, my first real point here is that movies are meant to be seen in a dark room where you have no real distractions. There aren't a bunch of people milling about. You don't have to do chores. You don't have the wife talking to you about washing the dishes or whatever, or having to feed the pets, none of that kind of nonsense. Watching it with that kind of focus and intensity really heightens the movie-going experience. And that's not even to talk about the size of the screen or that kind of stuff, which I'll get into. But the other thing is, having a live audience, I think, is vital for certain genres. Certainly, comedy works best with the other people laughing. Sometimes you miss a couple of the jokes because they might be laughing over them. But, you know, I've seen several movies at the theater that I thought were hilarious when I saw them in the theater, but watching them again, not so funny. In fact, I'll even admit I was fooled into thinking that the first scary movie was pretty funny because everyone I saw it with was just laughing, and in retrospect, not at all. Pretty terrible.
I think that what you say about movies being intended to be seen in a movie theater, I don't know that that's the case for all movies. Certainly, the big, large spectacles are meant to be seen. I think also certain comedies and maybe some other things. But increasingly, there's a, you know, with a lot of different outlets and ways to see movies, I think there's a lot of different filmmakers who are more and more ambivalent about where they're seen. And so I do think it depends on the movie sometimes. And the other thing about distractions, I'm actually much more distracted from a movie in the theater than I am at home. Certainly, I've been in people's homes where they flip a movie on, and even if there's no commercial breaks, you know, the neighbor's dog is barking at you, and there's all these different things going on. People come in and out of the house. You have to stop it to look up to greet them, and then you just miss an important scene. All that's nonsense. Definitely, I would prefer theater to that. But, you know, every time I go to the theater, I got people chewing popcorn with their mouths open right in the seat next to me, and people with their cell phones going off or talking about the plot. I've seen some couples that apparently are hard of hearing because they need to talk through the movie loudly. One time when I saw Harry Potter, there's a guy who hadn't taken a shower in months sitting next to me. How do you focus on the thing like that? So I think it depends on the environment. When I watch a movie at home, I make sure there's absolutely no distractions. Preferably it's at night too, the lights off. So I don't know.
Yeah, because for Harry Potter, you need full focus at all times. You can't possibly be distracted by anything.
Hey, you're the one making the argument about distractions.
Well, you know, a movie like Harry Potter brings me to my next point, which is spectacle. People like to say and make these absurd claims that, hey, I have my 40, 50, 60-inch HD plasma TV. It's just as good as a movie screen. That's ridiculous. You know what? Unless your television is 30 feet diagonal or bigger, you've got nothing on a movie screen. And you know what? No. Sitting close to your 40-inch TV ain't the same. Just because you got your nose up to it doesn't mean it looks as cool as having the screen completely engulf you and being able to see it from all sides. In fact, if you go to, you know, really good movie theaters with really big screens, it's even more impressive. One thing we're thinking about is if you got a widescreen TV, sure, that's great. But if the movie's wider than the 1.85:1 ratio, you're still going to get black bars on the tops and bottoms of your screen, so that 40 inches may become significantly less in terms of actual viewable area on the movie. And even if you look at current HD TVs, which, there's, I think, a dozen HD movies right now on DVD. If you really want to watch Ultraviolet a couple times, you can see it in high def. Have fun. But even high def only kind of approximates. It gets close. Some of the higher definition high def stuff gets about the same resolution as 35mm film, but nothing touches, say, 70mm. And if you've ever seen a movie like Ben-Hur or Lawrence of Arabia projected in 70mm on a big screen, you know that we're still a long, long way away from touching that with digital technology.
Absolutely. Yeah, this is not something I'll argue with you at all. You can equalize the viewing angle by getting your head up close, but your brain compensates for what it sees. If something's up close and it appears large in your field of vision, your brain makes it small to compensate, and that's why we don't think, you know, if somebody's up close to us, we think they're giants. I mean, our brains compensate, and absolutely, there's nothing like the spectacle of a humongous multi-story screen with an image projected on it. I think for some movies, that's not necessarily so important, though. And I'm not just talking about the big special effects movies. I think we've talked before about Lost in Translation, a very small-time movie, which is made very powerful by giving your attention to a large screen, but a quiet, subdued atmosphere for that to work. But I think a lot of movies don't really have any particular advantage on a large screen. So it depends on what you're seeing, I think.
I think everything seems better if it's bigger. I mean, that's the American philosophy.
Yeah, well,
if
I don't know.
It's bigger, it's better.
Okay, what about Scary Movie?
Are you a communist, Sam? Are you?
What about Scary Movie? Do you really want to see those big, humongous jokes, or do you just prefer to see it as little as possible?
I would much prefer that I had never seen that movie after that first time I saw it, because then I wouldn't, you know, have to feel ashamed for liking it that once. Anyway, moving on, I think my last point is people like to complain about the price of movies. Around where I am, a nighttime movie, and I'm in Southern California, a nighttime movie costs me $10, which I think is right about near the top. I think maybe in New York, like in Manhattan, it's $11 or $12 for a ticket. If you go to like some luxury theaters, it can be a little more. I know the Arclight in Los Angeles, which is a great movie theater, charges you $14 to get in the door at night. But, okay, if you want to buy a good home theater setup, and I think a lot of people making the movie theaters suck argument are home theater buffs, it's going to run you at least $3,000 to $4,000 to get a good HD TV. If you want an HD movie player, you're going to be spending $700 to $1,000 right now. So, you know, you're talking $3,000 to $4,000. At $10 a pop, that's 300 to 400 movie tickets you could be buying. That's a lot of movies. I doubt most people watch even 100 movies a year. I mean, that's several years worth of movies in the theater that you can get. Even if you're seeing 2 movies a week in the theater, it'll still take you 3 or 4 years to come close to matching the expense of decent home theater setup costs.
And yeah, and by the time you get through watching those 300 movies, then the technology's out of date and you have to upgrade again. So I'm kind of with you there. I actually don't have a huge home theater entertainment kind of setup at home, and I still do enjoy the movies. I just wish that I could be the only one in the theater. I think there are times when the theater-going experience is just too distracting, and you know, I get less out of a movie that way than for what the big screen and the good sound gives me. I wish that theaters would just fix this problem, and it's just ridiculous that there's so many theaters are paranoid about day-and-date releases of DVDs and things like that because they feel that they can't compete. It's strange for an industry to be admitting to itself, hey, we can't compete with home theaters. I mean, they got money, they have huge screens already. They should be able to build a better movie-going experience than what I can get at home. And in some cases, depending on the movie, that is still the case, but it should be so much better than it is right now. And I think that's just basically my argument here.
Well, I think, honestly, and I'll be fair, I've had some terrible experiences with movie theaters. There are a couple movie theaters near me that I avoid like the plague because they're always giving me trouble. Certainly, if you live in a metropolitan area, you have it better because you have a range of theaters you can choose to go to and avoid the crummy ones. But I wish movie theaters would actually try and enforce some standards of behavior for their people.
Sure.
Like I said, the Arclight in LA, it costs $14 to get in, but they have ushers, and there's no talking, and they don't tolerate that kind of nonsense, and you can't show up late, for instance, and climb past me during the first 15 minutes of the movie. And so I think if more movie theaters went toward that and stopped the ringing cell phones and didn't tolerate that kind of stuff, or even just kept the mechanical problems at bay, I have a great movie theater experience that maybe doesn't help my argument a lot, but I want to share it. When I saw the movie Adaptation, the final reel in the movie was screwed up. I don't know what the projectionists had done, but I saw the boom mic in every shot. Basically, if you ever see a boom mic in a theater, it's because the reel of film is off-kilter, the film is not being projected correctly. But I wasn't sure when I saw Adaptation if that was supposed to be the case or not, because the movie is, of course, about movies and about the artificiality of movies. And we were all laughing in the theater, and we couldn't figure out if this was part of the joke of the last bit of the film, the last act. But I'm still upset about this. After the movie was over, I complained to the manager and said, you know, I think that was framed wrong. I think you guys screwed that up. But was it supposed to be that way? And he said, oh, yeah, that's the way the movie's supposed to look. So it wasn't until I saw it on DVD that I knew for sure whether I was getting lied to or not. And in fact, yeah, turns out that I was, and I'm still kind of sore about that.
Of course, the other trick that movie theater owners who aren't very good pull on you is they try to extend the life of the projection bulb by turning it down so you get a darker movie than you should be experiencing. Ruins a lot of movies that way. And the irony is it doesn't actually extend the life of the projector bulb anyway. They just, right, people think it does, I guess. So, but I think that if theaters improve their standards and the mechanical problems and things like that, then I wouldn't have so much of a problem. I don't have a theater like the Arclight that you have in my area, and I have to travel at least 2 hours. And not a good 2 hours either, 2 hours through Boston. So, by the way, if you guys don't know, there's a little East versus West kind of thing happening here. I'm from the East Coast and Stephen's from the West Coast, so as the show progresses, you may find that reflected in our attitude sometimes, or maybe not.
Of course, living in Southern California, I have to spend 2 hours to get from my house to the grocery store because there's so much traffic. So, you know, for me, 2 hours to drive to a movie theater is nothing. So we've got another trivia question today, and I actually have one for Sam this time, which is something that probably won't happen too often, but it's a question that's going to go well with a film we're going to be discussing a little later called The Third Man, but that has Orson Welles in it, and the name of the movie in the trivia question today also has Orson Welles, and it has kind of a weird cast. It was one of Welles' last movies, and he made some sort of odd movies there in the later years of his life. So Welles is one of the people in it, but so are Eric Idle, Leonard Nimoy, Robert Stack, and Judd Nelson. It's a very strange cast list. So you have any idea what it is, Sam?
Yeah, I think it's three men and a big fat baby. And I think Orson Welles played the baby. Am I close?
No, not so far off either.
Oh.
But we'll get back to that near the end of the show.
All right, I'll think about it.
Last week, we talked about the background behind the James Bond series and recapped the first four movies. We left off with Thunderball, the biggest commercial success to date, but trouble is brewing. Connery was becoming more and more discontent in the role, and that's starting to be reflected in his performance on screen. Goldfinger was actually the last one where he seemed to enjoy himself. Now, this is the second in a series we're doing that recaps the Bond series, and we'll do some more leading up to the release of Casino Royale on November 17th. So, the next movie is You Only Live Twice, released in 1967, which is 2 years after Thunderball, so we're starting the tradition of having a Bond movie every 2 years, which actually I think is important for not burning out public interest in the character. But it's weird, because in the books, the so-called Blofeld trilogy consists of Thunderball, Honor Majesty's Secret Service, and You Only Live Twice in that order. It's the book trilogy where Bond deals with the character of Blofeld. And they're all pretty tightly interconnected in terms of plot, but for whatever reason, they filmed the trilogy out of order, and as a result, You Only Live Twice is the first Bond movie to differ substantially from the source material. It was adapted by children's author Roald Dahl, the author of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory and James and the Giant Peach.
Wait, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory?
Yes, absolutely.
So you're telling me that the producers, reading some kids' books, and thought, hey, this Chocolate Factory guy would be a great pick to make our spy action adventure movie.
Yes, they did.
I can see that. That makes perfect sense.
So it takes place largely in Japan, making this the first movie in the Bond series to establish the tradition of sending Bond to exotic locales. Until now, he'd just been to primarily just America and England and Russia. Now is a good time to mention the set designer, Ken Adam, because one of his great accomplishments is in this film, is this humongous, elaborate bad guy hideout in a volcano crater. The top of the volcano is actually this metal roof that opens and closes to let aircraft through, and inside, it's a huge complex with a monorail and everything. Ken Adam would do the set design for 7 of the Bond movies, and most of them stand out as having particularly impressive sets. Now, another first for this movie is that we see the face of Ernst Stahl. Favreau Blofeld. Unfortunately, he's played by Donald Pleasance, a great actor who turns in a good performance, but ultimately just doesn't have the stature that Blofeld was suggested to have, and he doesn't pose the physical threat to Bond that you think he should. The movie is pretty good, not great, a little languid, and that's probably the fault of director Lewis Gilbert, who just didn't have the confidence as a newcomer to the series to tighten it up, especially with a wildly famous and increasingly discontented star in the lead role. You Only Live Twice didn't make as much money, although it still did okay, but what we're just barely starting to see is the gradual decline of the Bond series over the next several years. One of the warning signs that the Bond series might be dying out was how it was becoming increasingly copied and parodied. Our Man Flint with James Coburn was a successful parody in 1966 and spawned a sequel. In particular, though, remember how the rights to Casino Royale were owned by somebody else? Eventually, they wound up in the hands of producer Charles K. Feldman, who wanted to collaborate with Eon Productions on a serious version, but Broccoli and Saltzman turned him down, perhaps wishing not to repeat the arrangement made with Kevin McClory for Thunderball. So Feldman made his own movie, and he made it into a parody and released it a couple months before You Only Live Twice. We'll talk more about this movie in detail in a later segment of this series, but for now, let's just make the point that Bond had become fodder for parody, and historically that's a warning sign that whatever is being parodied might be on the verge of going out of fashion.
One thing I know you've mentioned before when we've talked about Bond, Sam, is that you consider Bond to be almost a parody in and of itself, a parody of the spy genre. Do you want to talk about that at all?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why it's so difficult to make a good parody of Bond. Of course, Austin Powers did it, but it was a long time before we had a really good parody of Bond, because Bond himself is sort of a heightened, romanticized, and tongue-in-cheek version of actual spy stories that were in fashion previously. Spy movies were not taken to this level of dramatic highs and outrageous stunts and things like that before, so it's sort of a parody of spy movies in the past.
Yeah, when you have Austin Powers making these double entendres, but the Bond series already does that. It's not 100% serious. I mean, it's lots of jokes in the Bond movies anyway to begin with, so it's always kind of weird that it gets parodied so much.
Right. Anyway, moving along to 1969, we come to Honor Majesty's Secret Service. Connery had quit the series, and the big question on everybody's mind was, can the series sustain itself without Connery in the lead role? Actually, this question went unanswered for longer than you might think. Anyway, for the next movie, the producers considered a couple of different actors. One was Timothy Dalton, who thought himself too young at the time and turned the role down. Another was Roger Moore, but he was still under contract to do The Saint on TV, so he had to turn it down too. Well, you know who else turned it down? Adam West from the Batman television series. Close call there.
Wow, I bet he's kicking himself over that one.
I think so. Ultimately, though, of course, they settled on George Lazenby, who is a model, not an actor, but he had the looks and presence and poise they were looking for. The problem was, as soon as he signed on, it all went to his head and he became impossible to work with. It was a pretty rough time on the set, but to be fair, Lazenby's performance really isn't that bad. Sometimes he tries just a little too hard to imitate Connery, but his performance works in general, I think. And the movie is very good. A lot of critics think this would have been the best film in the series if Connery had started the role. Some think it's the best film in the series anyway, but it's frustrating because we got perhaps the pivotal entry in the series in terms of the Bond character, done by an actor who only ever did the one Bond film, so we don't have as strong a connection with the rest of the series that we really should have for this very key film. This is the episode where Bond actually falls in love with the Bond girl, this time played with elegance and style by Diana Rigg from the British TV series The Avengers. Actually, this was one of four crossovers between the actors in that series and this one. Anyway, the two characters get married, which actually makes the second time he's gotten married in the series, if you count the questionably legal marriage in You Only Live Twice. But this is the relationship that gets to him emotionally. It's probably no secret that she dies since she's not still around later in the series, and when that happens is something in Bond breaks and is never quite the same again. This episode in his life comes up now and again later in the series and remains a sore spot for him, and that adds to the real hatred he has for his job. Now, Blofeld returns as the villain. This time he's played by Telly Savalas, who might have been great in the role if he hadn't been so American. There's actually a weird thing about this. When Bond and Blofeld meet, they seem not to recognize each other, even though they had previously met in You Only Live Twice. This is kind of a byproduct of the fact that these two books were adapted out of order, but since both characters are now played by different actors, the series kind of gets away with this discontinuity. The film was directed by Peter Hunt, who worked as an editor and second unit director on prior Bond films and was instrumental in cutting the early movies together in a way that gave them an exciting, modern kind of feel. This is also a good time to mention composer John Barry. Some of its absolute best and most memorable work is here, but he actually worked on 12 Bond movies up to the Timothy Dalton era, and I really think it's Barry that is more responsible than any single person for giving the series such a distinctive feel to it. His scores superficially seem like bright, sunny orchestral pieces, but there's this dangerous, lurid, wild, exotic undercurrent to his music that just perfectly complements the Bond character and his world.
Absolutely, and of course, he's one of the few overtly static elements in terms of things that we see or hear. Obviously, some of the producers remain through the movies, but they change stars constantly, and the writers are going all over the place. And so I think it's interesting that he sort of provides a real link between all the films.
Absolutely. So, a great film, but kind of a big-time financial disappointment. It wasn't a flop. It wasn't a money loser like a lot of people think it was, but it was the weakest performing Bond to date. So, the first attempt without Connery, kind of a commercial failure, and Lazenby opted out of the series, which was a decision he would later regret. So once again, the producers would have to search for a new Bond. Now for Bond actor number three, American actor John Gavin was cast as Bond, and he was the guy who played Sam Loomis in Psycho. But the studio heads at United Artists didn't like this choice, which is just as well, because I think Bond can't be American. That's an important thing there. So they asked Broccoli and Saltzman, the producers, to get Connery back, no matter the cost. And they did. Connery got an unprecedented deal, and he was back in the role again. They also brought back Shirley Bassey, who sang the theme song. She had previously sung the iconic Goldfinger theme and would later sing Moonraker. She's the only singer in a long line to provide the theme song for more than one Bond film. Now, the movie, Diamonds Are Forever, it's okay. The opening is really good. Connery is on this angry rampage trying to track down Blofeld because of what happened in the previous movie. Although that angle kind of gets forgotten later on, I think the producers preferred not to make too much of a connection with this other Bond actor and this lesser performing movie. And also, Diamonds Are Forever is hurt quite a bit by the extensive American setting. For some reason, Bond movies rarely work well, except maybe for the first few, when they're set in America. He should be in more exotic places. And the film has kind of a cheap look to it, too. And the other problem is the casting of the character of Blofeld. He's played by Charles Gray, who actually appeared in You Only Live Twice as a different character. But he just doesn't have the threatening presence on screen. He's a nice guy. So the confrontation between him and Bond lacks the tension it should have had. The film was directed by Guy Hamilton, who had previously directed Goldfinger, and this was the first of three more in a row he would direct, but as a director, he was losing his edge by this point. His style didn't quite mesh with how Bond and filmmaking styles in general had evolved in the intervening years. All the same, Diamonds Are Forever is a decent entry in the series.
I think some of that unevenness you mentioned is just almost necessary when you have a franchise that goes on for so long and changes actors all the time. There's really no way around it. You can't keep real good continuity, and so when the producers tried to introduce longer-running elements, the Blofeld-Bond rivalry, I think it gets into trouble because nothing's staying the same when you're up to six or seven movies.
Yeah, and definitely the way Bond has survived is by adapting to the times as the decades have gone by, and so it's done a really rare thing. Most movie franchises kind of die out because they go out of fashion or whatever, and Bond evolved. So, yeah, I think continuity problems were inevitable. But at this point in time, the question of the viability of Bond without Connery was still up in the air, and Connery wasn't going to come back for another one. So producers considered a number of people, including Jeremy Brett, who would later play Sherlock Holmes in the PBS series. But finally they settled on Roger Moore, whose contract for The Saint was no longer an issue as it was 4 years prior. The producers were so confident that Moore would fit right into the role that they didn't even really bother to give him a built-up entrance for his first scene, as with all the other actors who played Bond. He's just sort of suddenly there. More or less, they were right. Moore fit the role very nicely. Although many people don't like the more campy tones of many of the Roger Moore films, myself included, Moore himself does a good job. And Live and Let Die actually has quite an edge to it. There's this great scene where Bond has been captured, and one of the henchmen has this metal claw for a hand around Bond's little finger, and he's just waiting on the boss for the word to snap it off. This is a really tense scene, and it's one of those rare but precious moments in the series where you really feel like Bond is in true danger, that he won't just be able to slip out of the problem and issue a snazzy one-liner and move on his merry way. There's some great villains in this one. Yaphet Kotto as Kananga, Julius Harris as Teehee, and Jeffrey Holder as Baron Samedi, a voodoo witch doctor. There's also a noteworthy Bond girl in Jane Seymour, one of a very few Bond girls to have a substantial career outside of the Bond movie series. She, of course, would go on to do Dr. Quinn on television and a number of other things. This movie also marks the first of two appearances by a comic character, Sheriff J.W. Pepper, a redneck cop that Bond runs afoul of during a motorboat chase. I admit it, I like this character, but I shouldn't, but I think he's funny. A little bit goes a long way, however. When he reappears in the next movie, he's definitely overstayed his welcome. The other character I want to mention is Felix Leiter, who is a CIA agent that Bond sometimes has contact with. The Leiter character appears throughout the Bond series, starting from the beginning in Dr. No, where he was played by Jack Lord. But he was never played by the same actor twice, except by David Hedison, who played the lead in the original version of The Fly. Anyway, Hedison plays him here in Live and Let Die, and again 16 years later in License to Kill, which is interesting because one of the big scenes in the Live and Let Die novel that was not used in the movie was a scene where Felix Leiter gets fed to sharks. Well, that scene was later used in the movies in License to Kill, so Hedison got to play that big Leiter scene after all. Anyway, Live and Let Die wasn't such a big hit in the U.S., but it made a lot of money overseas. Again, though, despite some big strengths in spots, it's not a very strong movie overall. The formula is starting to wear a little thin, and like Diamonds Are Forever, it has a really cheap look to it. So the question of Bond's viability post-Connery is still up in the air.
Yeah, and of course the next movie isn't going to help matters a whole lot, is it?
Not at all. Not at all, because that is The Man with the Golden Gun. Producers wanted to solidify more in the role of Bond, so they rushed out the second one in 1 year. It was released in 1974, and this movie is downright terrible. I think it's the worst in the series by far. There's really nothing good to say about this. Christopher Lee, who's actually Ian Fleming's cousin, plays a villain, and that should have been a great opportunity for a great villain, but he's utterly wasted. The Bond girls are more wooden than usual in their acting. There's nothing in the visuals or the sets that are worth anything. Even composer John Barry was having an off day. Actually, there's one good part, and that's a corkscrew car jump stunt that Bond performs. The producers took out a patent on it years before, so nobody else would do it before they could work it into a Bond movie. This was actually the first stunt to be planned out by a computer, and it was performed in one take. So that's about 5 seconds into this movie that isn't terrible.
Are you saying that the three-nippled Scaramanga, I mean, the great three-nipple scene isn't fascinating?
Yeah, moving right along. One of the worst parts is how the movie cashes in on a martial arts fad that was happening at the time, thanks to Bruce Lee. It's just awful, and it has the most unbelievable anticlimax you can imagine. The big showdown between Bond and the villain at the end just involves the two of them creeping around for a while, and then Bond just shoots him, just like that. The end. It's horrible. And that was reflected by the critics in the box office. This was a real dud. Meanwhile, Harry Saltzman, one of the two producers of the Bond series all along, sold his 50% interest in the Bond films to United Artists, so that left Albert R. Broccoli without his partner from the very beginning. So that leaves the series in a precarious position. Conventional wisdom would have been that the Bond series couldn't recover. Any other film series that follows this general arc of peaking early, then gradually declining in quality and commercial interest, and ending in a dud like that, especially after the recasting of the lead character, it just peters out. There's really no reason at this time to think that Bond would be any different, and now, with one of the two producers out the door, surely it would be that much more difficult to kick some life back into the series. Well, obviously we know Bond survives the 70s, but we'll find out how next week when we explore how Bond was revived and then reinvented during the Roger Moore years.
One of the confusing things about being a film buff is all the jargon that gets bandied about, and if you don't really spend a lot of time reading and studying, you'd be confused because people will use words without ever bothering to define them. What we're going to do is premiere a new segment where we hope to talk regularly about some of the terms that get used. And we're going to start with some basic ones and also cover maybe some other ones that maybe you're not so familiar with. And I thought a good place to start with this segment would be with the word cut. What is a cut? Well, first of all, cut is what they yell on set. That means stop. We're done with that take. But we're more interested in it as an editing term. Probably most people know what it is, but we can maybe use a little bit of review and maybe talk a little bit about what makes cuts so interesting. The term cut basically comes from the act of actually cutting film in the editing room. if you think about filming, movie cameras have a long reel of film that's constantly going, and between takes, and a take, by the way, if you don't know, since we're being really basic here, is just the basic unit of filming. They set up the camera, the actors do their lines, that's a take. If they screw it up, they do another take, and they do usually several takes per every shot that they want in a movie. So if you've got all these different takes and you want to link two of them together, you've got to cut stuff between them, and that's where the word cut comes from. Now, we think of it more often, the word cut, in terms of what we actually see on the screen. So anytime that our viewpoint as the viewer, that is, the view of the camera that we're looking at the movie through, anytime that it changes abruptly, that's a cut. A cut is different from a camera movement. That's where we actually feel our point of view moving. A cut is abrupt, and movies today have lots of cuts in them. But it wasn't always that way. I hope sooner or later to do a bit on the history of film editing, but real briefly, the earliest films were very short silent movies, and they didn't actually have any cuts. They were just a single continuous take. And in fact, it wasn't until the early 1900s, film actually began sometime in the 1890s, depending on how you want to count it, but it wasn't until the very early 1900s that people started really cutting their movies. In fact, 1904 or so, where they first started actually like cutting out bits of narrative that weren't important. And before then, basically they showed every bit of the story. They didn't cut things out like that. And so the idea of actually cutting film and working with it wasn't really even developed until a lot later. In the 1910s, D.W. Griffith was very famously involved in moving editing forward, in using cutting, which is kind of jarring to move between characters and actions happening at the same time. This is called cross-cutting. He very, very famously did it in his feature film, Birth of a Nation, where he would cut between these people being attacked and then cut to the writers writing to save them. Of course, in Birth of a Nation, it's the Ku Klux Klan running to the rescue, which is one of the reasons that's such a problematic movie, but I digress. Cuts really became more important in the 1920s when Soviet filmmakers, most famously Sergei Eisenstein, worked on coming up with a whole theory of editing, and they performed some interesting experiments. For instance, they filmed an actor with a blank expression, and then they would show that to an audience, and they would cut to, say, a piece of meat that he's looking at. And they would ask the audience, well, what do you think the actor's expression is? They say, well, he looks hungry. Now, they'd show that same shot of an actor looking blank to an audience, but a different audience this time, and instead of cutting to a piece of meat, they cut to a beautiful woman. What is the actor looking like? The audience says, oh, he looks like he's in love, or he's lusting after this woman. Same blank expression, but the important thing is that when we see that transition, the cut, the audience automatically gets meaning from it. We actually subconsciously are able to read cuts as believing, okay, there's meaning here, because we're cutting from one thing to another. It means something, and it's important. And it's from that base that now cuts happen all the time in movies. Generally, most shots in a movie don't last much longer than 10 to 30 seconds, maybe a little longer.
Unless Michael Bay is directing.
I was going to mention, some people would slight a director like Michael Bay. He directed The Rock and Armageddon, Bad Boys, those sorts of movies, and he's very famous for his very, very fast-paced cutting style. In his action scenes, he cuts constantly, with some shots being just fractions of seconds, even. And, of course, the counterexample to it is the long shot and the long take. And because there are a lot of directors who feel that cutting is actually a lie, there's that old film saying that every cut is a lie because it hides something from the audience, cuts aren't natural. A lot of directors prefer to use long takes and long shots. Now, there are different types of cuts that we'll talk about in the future. There's the jump cut or the smash cut. And, of course, it'd also be interesting to contrast the idea of cutting with the idea of what do you gain from a very long take? Well, you gain maybe the idea that it feels more natural, it's also very showy, and I hope later on when we talk about cameras that we'll talk more about tracking shots and that sort of thing.
There's an interesting thing that comes to mind. I remember reading David Mamet's book about directing, and he was saying that the stories are told through the cuts, and it goes back to what you're saying about the blank expression and cutting away from it. If you cut to, for example, a wolf bounding through the snow, and then you cut to a bunch of bunny rabbits hiding, then immediately the audience, and without even really thinking about it, makes the connection, okay, he's hunting them. But in reality, these could have been filmed decades apart on different continents and different times, but the cut tells you the story of hunting. And the other thing is just a little bit of trivia, really. I just think it's kind of interesting that the word cut in English means to cut things apart, to separate them. And in the movies, you get these strange situations where you cut things together, which basically means edit a movie and take all the different takes and construct a single whole. so you cut things together. Just kind of a strange use
sure.
of the term.
And that's where you get other terms like the director's cut or the final cut. In Hollywood slang, the cut is the finished film. In other words, the edited version of the movie. So if you come out with a director's cut, this is the director's preferred version of the movie that in which he had control over all the edits. You know, one thing that we like to sort of rag on movies about is how often they seem to be lacking for original material. But this isn't always a bad thing, and some of the best movies ever made have been adaptations. Today we're going to go ahead and do our top six list, not top five. Why, Sam?
Because six is one more than five.
That's right, it's one higher. So we're going to do our top six list today about movies that are based on other material. Books, plays, music, comic books, whatever it is, in which the movie, the adaptation, is actually more definitive than the original. That is, when you think of that title, you think of a movie and not the thing that it was based off of. And so a few ground rules before we begin. We're not going to pick anything that was based off material that basically you never would have heard of. So Casablanca, for instance, was based on an unproduced play, but it's not really eligible because, of course, Casablanca is the definitive version of that story. The play was never made. No one ever saw it.
Yeah, and To Have and Have Not, which is a famously superior movie adaptation of a Hemingway story, would have been at the top of my list, but they have nothing in common. Stephen, I was expecting this list to be super easy, but I wound up with a short list that wasn't very short at all, because the conventional wisdom is that the book is always better. And, you know, to give people an idea of just how many movies I considered, here are some that I was. Blade Runner, Men in Black, The Silence of the Lambs, The Jungle Book, A Clockwork Orange, Superman, The Andromeda Strain, Conan the Barbarian, Deliverance, The Third Man, Elmer Gantry, 2001, The Last Picture Show, Breakfast at Tiffany's, and dozens of Hitchcock titles. And not all of those are better than the source material, but definitely an argument could be made that they're more definitive.
Yeah, and what I was definitely looking for was, when you think of a title, you think of the movie, and maybe probably don't even think of the original work at all. So let's jump in. My number six is Fight Club, the 1999 film by David Fincher, which is based on a novel by Chuck Palahniuk, whose name I probably just butchered. But it's a pretty good novel, and the movie follows very closely to it, but I think the movie has become a real cult favorite in the last 7 years or so. And it's interesting because the two are so similar. The movie, in my mind, I've read the book and seen the movie absolutely is a better version. It more, I think, coherently captures the spirit of what the book was trying to do, and it also improved drastically upon the ending of the book, which I always thought was a little weak.
So can we get a third adaptation that improves upon the ending of the movie?
I don't think you could possibly improve upon the ending of the movie.
Okay, well, maybe that's a subject for a controversial take later. Anyway, my number six, while very good, I actually think Dr. Zhivago is one of David Lean's weaker epics, but the Russian novel by Boris Pasternak was never going to become an icon of the public consciousness. By contrast, the movie grossed more money than every other David Lean movie put together, and the image of Omar Sharif trudging through a frozen wasteland is instantly recognizable.
Yeah, that's a good pick. In fact, I think David Lean, maybe you could also argue that Lawrence of Arabia, which is technically based off of Lawrence's autobiography, is probably more definitive as well, also
yeah.
directed by David Lean.
Absolutely.
My number five pick is the 2001 film Black Hawk Down by director Ridley Scott, based on the true book by reporter Mark Bowden. I don't know that many people even know necessarily that there was originally a book, but the two work well together. Both are, of course, based on actual fact, but I think because war is such a visceral thing and Scott did such a great job with the movie, when we think of that battle, I at least always think of the movie and not the book, even though the book is an absolutely great complement to the film and that it really fleshes out the story and gives you more of a what actually happened, whereas the movie just captures really, I think, the spirit of the confusion and the chaos of that battle.
That's a great movie. My number five, Peter Benchley's novel Jaws, spent 44 weeks on the bestseller list, but critics didn't think much of it, and director Steven Spielberg said he found the character so unsympathetic he wanted the shark to win. Spielberg's movie cuts out some of the character subplots he found troublesome and focused on the suspense angle. Besides being regarded to this day as a classic, while the novel is pretty much forgotten, the movie changed the face of Hollywood marketing, single-handedly changing summertime from a movie dumping grounds to a place where blockbusters would really be crowded in. It's also the first movie widely promoted on television, and obviously the studios were quick to follow suit. So besides the movie itself being iconic, it changed the face of the industry as well. That's how broad its ramifications were.
Yeah, that's a very good pick. I kind of didn't think of it because I forgot that Jaws was a novel, even though in the back of my head somewhere I knew that. My number four pick, probably not as maybe as definitive, it's Gone with the Wind, the 1939 film by Victor Fleming and six other people, depending on who you ask. But anyway, it's based on a very famous novel by Margaret Mitchell. And I think probably the novel is still fairly well known, people know about it. But the movie is just so ingrained in us in film history. It's such an iconic film that in so many ways everyone has seen, and that when you think of, you know, Frankly, My Dear, I Don't Give a Damn, you don't think of words on a page, but you think of Clark Gable saying it at the end of that film.
Yeah, this is one of the titles we'll talk about where the novel also stands up today, but definitely I think the movie is much more of an icon. My number four is a tie between some 15 or 16 titles. It's the James Bond series, which we've been talking about lately on the podcast. Most of the 21 official movies are based on Ian Fleming's story. Some are better and some are worse than the original stories. But say James Bond to somebody, and they will think of Sean Connery or Pierce Brosnan or Roger Moore long before the books ever occur to them.
I would have actually picked this, except I knew for a fact that you were going to take it, so I went ahead and didn't put it on my list. But yeah, definitely, I think the novels are sort of forgotten, except by Bond freaks like yourself. My number three pick is a movie whose original source material is pretty much forgotten, and that's The Shawshank Redemption, the 1994 film by Frank Darabont. It's actually based on a short story called Rita Hayworth and The Shawshank Redemption by Stephen King, of all people. And a lot of times when I get into conversations with people about this movie, they have no idea that Stephen King wrote a short story that it was based on. So I think that the movie has definitely become an icon in the last 12 years since its release. And definitely the story, you pretty much never hear anything about. It wasn't really a big hit when it was released. Obviously, short stories pretty much aren't big hits anymore. And so the movie, while a definite popular favorite, completely overshadows its source material.
Yeah, the story is just not even nearly as... It doesn't have nearly the impact that the movie has. I might have put this on my list. I knew for a fact, however, that you would put it on yours, so I skipped it. Anyway, my number three is The Godfather from 1972. It's based on a 1969 novel by Mario Puzo, and the screenplay was co-authored by him and Francis Ford Coppola, who directed the film. Now, however popular the book may be, it was the movie that cemented its place in narrative fiction, and for that matter, an actual mafia culture. The title The Godfather, as well as the tradition of kissing the family Don's ring, for example, were fictional inventions that later fell into actual use. Fortunately, I don't think that happened with the whole horse head thing, but definitely a very definitive movie.
Absolutely, and I'm actually surprised that I didn't pick it again. I think it wasn't really on the top of my mind just because I, again, forget that it was a novel. And speaking of popular novels that became films in which the films completely overshadowed the novel, I have The Exorcist from 1973 by William Friedkin. It was actually based on a novel called The Exorcist by William Peter Blatty, and it was published in 71, and the novel was a huge hit. And in fact, it's interesting because I'm not so sure how many people remember the novel at all. The movie pretty much instantly became one of the most successful horror movies, and even today it's probably one of, if not the most iconic of the horror films. What's interesting to me, though, is that in some versions of the film, especially the re-release that came out not too long ago, William Peter Blatty's name is, before the title, it's William Peter Blatty's The Exorcist, which is weird. He wrote the novel, but he didn't direct the film. And it's interesting that the story that he came up with has completely overshadowed his work, even though he is still mentioned all the time in conjunction with the movie.
That is kind of funny. My number two is actually a work of classic literature adapted in 1931 to a classic film that pervades the public consciousness to this day. It is called Frankenstein, written by Mary Shelley in 1818. Her story is a meaty exploration of a lot of questions about life and the ethics of handling life, but today her eloquent, philosophizing creature is virtually unrecognized in light of Boris Karloff's iconic mute performance. Almost every interpretation of Frankenstein since, whether it's in Japanese monster movies or Abbott and Costello parodies or whatever, is really based on the movie, not the book.
Interesting, because I also have another horror pick for my number one that's couple different horror movies we've had now, and that is Psycho from 1960 by Alfred Hitchcock, based on the novel Psycho by Robert Bloch. I kind of thought about this for a while, and it took me a long time to remember, again, that Psycho was originally a novel. It was just sort of floating there in my mind somewhere. But the movie is one of the most famous movies of all time. So many just absolutely classic sequences, especially the infamous shower scene, which is just a masterpiece of editing, and Psycho was the film that pretty much invented the slasher genre. There had been horror movies before it, but the film took everything to a new level. It showed us how you could be scary and violent, even in the early 1960s, where the production code was still in effect and you couldn't really show a whole lot of blood. But Hitchcock managed to make a slasher flick in those conditions that has absolutely positively changed the face of pretty much every horror, or even, you know, movies like Silence of the Lambs would not have come about were it not for Psycho.
Yeah, in 1960 there were actually two similar movies to come out around that time about serial killers. Psycho, the other one was Peeping Tom. Both were about serial killers and handled them in a modern sense that they had not been handled before.
Of course, wasn't Peeping Tom a British film, so it wouldn't have been subject to the same, I think, production code that Hitchcock was working under. A little easier, I think, to be perhaps a little more graphic over there.
But it was still a progressive movie, is what I'm trying to say. And although it was not successful either, so it didn't have the influence Psycho had, but I do think it's important to mention those two together. And I just wish every slasher movie that it has inspired harken back to and understood what made both of these two movies so creepy and effective. They did not show the stuff. You know, it's not just a matter of seeing a knife gouge into somebody and the blood spraying. That shower scene in Psycho is so iconic, so remembered. My mother is still afraid of taking a shower from having seen this in her teenage years when it came out. But really, when you look at it shot by shot, you don't really see a lot of explicit violence. You see a lot of suggestion. It looks like you're seeing what's going on. You just are able to imagine the graphic parts and fill in. Your imagination can always come up with something better than what you're shown.
Of course, I don't think modern slasher flicks are interested in actually being scary. They're completely some weird, different thing.
Yeah, well, some of them are trying, I think, but...
Yeah, maybe. As far as I can tell, they're mainly about watching people get mutilated these days.
Yeah, which is unfortunate. My number one is a little different. It's a fun, whimsical book and an absolutely adored movie. It's called The Princess Bride, both the novel and the movie written by William Goldman. The movie is one of the most quotable of all time. I remember seeing this at the theater on my university campus years ago, quite a few years ago now, and just about everybody around me was mouthing the dialogue as it occurred. This is an unlikely classic. If you look at it analytically, it's rough around the edges with the acting and the editing and so forth, but somehow this movie is so perfect where it counts and has such a wonderful sense of humor and tone that it's just such a great time to watch this, and it holds up as well or better with repeated viewings.
And I would like to make the claim that The Princess Bride, the film, is significantly better than the book. I think Goldman fixed a lot of the problems his novel had, particularly the ending, and I think the movie wisely drops a lot of the extra stuff of running through the novel about how it was originally a different book, and now the narrator is fixing it for us as he goes, and all that kind of meta stuff that was kind of clever but got really old really quick. The movie just boils down the essence of a fairy tale and gives us exactly what we want.
Right.
All right, my top six are Fight Club from 1999, Black Hawk Down from 2001, Gone with the Wind from 1939, The Shawshank Redemption from 1994, The Exorcist from 1973, and from 1960, my number one adaptation that's more definitive than the original source material is Psycho, the probably most definitive horror film ever made.
And my number six, Dr. Zhivago from 1965. Number five, Jaws from 1975. Number four, the James Bond film starting in 1962. Number three, The Godfather, 1972. Number two, Frankenstein from 1931. And my number one, The Princess Bride from 1987.
We're going to start a new segment that we hope to do pretty regularly here at All Movie Talk called a Film Spotlight. The idea is we just pick a film that we happen to like for whatever reason that we think maybe we should talk about that you might be interested in seeing. And so today we're going to start out with one of my personal favorite movies. It's a strange little movie, pretty famous, but maybe not seen as much as it should be. And that movie is 1949's The Third Man, directed by Carol Reed, who... sort of a strange directorial career. He's most famous for this film and also the musical Oliver. He's a good pick to direct this weird movie that stars Joseph Cotten as an American writer in post-war Vienna, and who comes looking for his friend Harry Lime, only to find that his friend has been killed, and he sets about trying to investigate the murder. Orson Welles plays... well, you'll have to watch it to find out who he plays, but he shows up into the movie about an hour in when an absolutely memorable role. He has one of the all-time great movie entrances, and we'll talk about that. A screenplay is written by Graham Greene, the novelist, and based on one of his novels, sort of known for his stories about intrigue. And this is absolutely... no different. This is takes place, like I said, in post-war Vienna, filmed in 1949. And I think what makes this movie particularly compelling today is how well it captures that sense of Vienna. And at this point in time, a pivotal plot point in the movie is that Vienna is divided up into four zones. One's controlled by the Americans, the British, the Russians, so on, because, you know, these are the victors of World War II, and they're controlling this area. And there's a weird little section in the middle that's kind of neutral, and is patrolled by an international force, none of whom can speak the same language. This is such a strange place. It reminds me almost of a science fiction movie or something, this premise of, it's almost like a space station in Star Trek or something like that.
Yeah, it's a movie that has to build the world before it can really tell the story, or at least unfold them at the same time, so you're getting two tasks done for the price of one.
And in fact, it starts off with a little narration about what the heck's going on in Vienna at this point in time. And the great thing is that it's filmed entirely on location in Vienna right after the war, when Vienna is like this great ancient European city where around the corner there's rubble everywhere you look. And it's really strange seeing that. And in fact, the movie itself is very strange. Highly stylized and very well remembered for its use of constantly tilting camera angles. There's almost nothing in this movie that's shot straight. Every other shot is at a 45-degree angle. It feels like a German film from the 20s at times. And one of the most interesting things about this, I think, is the score. It was done on a zither, which is a stringed instrument, and composed by Anton Karas. But it's the music is kind of jaunty. I know Roger Ebert, one of his reviews of The Third Man, said that he doesn't think there's a movie that has music better suited to it. And while I might agree with that, what I think is interesting is that the music doesn't go with the movie at all. It's well suited to it, but it's consistently going against the action. It's contrasting with it. It's this sort of happy, almost carnival music. And so while Joseph Cotten is trying to find how his friend was killed and running through the streets of Vienna being chased by smugglers and racketeers, there's this jaunty little happy carnival music that's playing, and it's very strange, very weird, but it works perfectly. And it's one of the few movie scores I can think of where the music is directly commenting on the action. It's kind of ironic, and one of the sort of recurring themes in the movie is that the Joseph Cotten character is a complete and total bumbler. Here he is trying to ravel this mystery that involves a third man being seen at the death of his friend. But he's constantly getting things wrong. He's making the wrong assumptions, trust the wrong people. And the idea is that he's this failed writer of these bad westerns who's not very good, not very well respected, and doesn't understand the landscape, doesn't understand what's going on, and is constantly being made fun of by the characters in the movie, and I think partially by the music.
Actually, I saw this not for the first time, fortunately, but I saw this with a number of people who were not used to seeing older movies, definitely not older film noir or crime mysteries or anything like that. And they said that the music was really repetitive and kind of distracted them. And I think, I don't know, that may indicate to me that this actually isn't the place to start if you want to start watching older crime films. But it is an indication that you're right. It does contrast. It's not what we're used to. It's a bit of a jolt not to see kind of a creepy visual or something that might have some tension in it, and then have the music come in on a zither. And we're used to these cues where the music is ominous and you're just waiting for that sharp jump chord when the cat leaps out at you. And it's just none of that at all here. So it's kind of a jolt. You have to kind of go with it and then see what the film is doing that's going to be a little different.
Well, yeah, and I don't think there's another movie quite like The Third Man. It's unique in cinema history, and Reed does a great job of being able to build tension without using necessarily the normal tools. By the time we get to the sort of the final, very memorable sequence in which there's a chase through the sewers of Vienna, and it's very, very tense, but it works not despite the music, which is contrasting the action, but because of it. It creates an atmosphere, and by the time it's been running for a while, you kind of get into it. I think if you're willing to give it a chance, I think it stands out very well. It's sort of a modern movie in the way that it doesn't play to conventions at all. And so it's very stylized. I mentioned that the main character is a bumbler, and the movie's very funny. I watched again right before we did this segment, and I forgot how funny it was. For instance, one of the recurring jokes is names are constantly being misspoken. Cotton's character is this American who can't speak any other language besides English, and even though, you know, he's a writer, doesn't necessarily speak English all that well. But he can never get anyone's name right. He can't pronounce any words. At one point, this woman that he's hanging around, who he likes, that she doesn't really care much for him, she was the love interest of the friend that he came to visit. You know, she actually accidentally calls him Harry, the name of the guy who's dead. It's this sort of like this running theme that no one can get anyone's names right. And I think part of that plays into the idea that no one really knows what's going on. No one can communicate with one another in this city, and no one understands what the heck is happening except perhaps these sort of racketeers who are lurking in the middle of things and are taking advantage of this situation where none of the law enforcement can communicate.
Yeah, you're right. There's another thing going on, though, I think, secondary, but another thing. You know, nobody ever misspeaks in the movies. When they misspeak, they do another take. It goes along hand-in-hand kind of with nobody ever goes to the bathroom, because that's all when the camera's off.
Right. Well, if they go to the bathroom, you know something bad's going to happen.
That's right. So it's a plot point if there's a bathroom in a movie. And likewise, it's stylized if people are misspeaking. And so almost The Third Man is more effective the way it plays with people misspeaking than if movies were more true to life in general, more typical for somebody to misspeak when they're addressing someone.
Absolutely. One thing we should talk about with the style is the camera work. I mentioned earlier that it's constantly askew, but not only that, is the it's very harsh lighting. It almost has a noir feel to it, and I want to talk about that in just a sec, whether or not it's a noir film. But this idea that everything is askew and very black and white is very, very expressionistic in the way it works, because, of course, our main character has no clue what's going on at any point in the film, and every time he thinks he understands what's going on, he's completely wrong about it. Very unsettling the way it looks. And there are a couple other really famous shots. Reed has a real eye for photography here. There's this really long shot. The final shot in the movie is a character walking past another character, and as the character is standing there, expecting the other character to come talk to him, that character just keeps walking past, and it echoes a shot earlier in the film, but it's a very memorable shot, and that one's filmed pretty straight on, but for the most part, it's very expressionistic, getting inside of the characters' heads through the use of camera work.
It's also worth mentioning a very famous shot also toward the end where some fingers try to reach through a grate, and that's all you can see. You know, that's a real defining shot there.
So much is said in that one scene,
right,
that when you see that, it means, oh, now you really feel the impact.
Yeah. Just as an aside, by the way, that was actually the director's fingers coming through the grate. It wasn't the actor who it should have been.
And another great shot that we absolutely have to mention is the introduction of Orson Welles. He appears just around an hour into the film. It's about halfway into the movie. He shows up, and he's hiding, trying to tail somebody. He's hiding in this dark alley, and it's revealed when someone overhead casts a light on him. And this light just suddenly, out of the shadows, appears Orson Welles' face. And at first he looks surprised, but as the shot holds, he kind of smiles, and you're sort of reminded that Orson Welles really got famous not for great dramatic roles, but for his sort of playing around on the radio and having fun, the sort of boyish sense that's really captured perfectly, and just grins, and then and the light goes off and he disappears once again in the darkness.
Yeah,
it's really brilliant.
It's hard to define why this is so memorable, too. I don't know that I can identify what it is. It may be the most famous entrance of a character in any movie, but it's all based on Orson Welles' smile and the lighting.
Yeah, and also, to an extent, it's within the story. It's an interesting introduction. Welles is a great actor and just perfectly captures a particular spirit without saying a thing, which I think is difficult for actors to do. Now, one thing I do want to talk about is, do you think this movie is a noir?
Not really. I used the word earlier, but it's just because I don't have any other word to use to describe it. It uses those techniques, and so it kind of feels that way in some sense. But no, I think you nailed it earlier. It defies description.
I definitely think it has the style of a noir, in terms of the way it looks. It's very noirish. There's a really good other movie podcast out there called Out of the Past, Investigating Film Noir, and they did an entire episode on this, which is probably worth listening to on the website. We'll put a link to that. Their take on this movie was that what really separates it from being a noir is its value system. It doesn't have the sort of bleak noir values. In fact, the Orson Welles character sort of has the value system that a noir character might end up having, the sort of, you know, me for me and screw everyone else attitude. But the movie does not. The movie is a little more optimistic about human nature than most noir films, I think, are. Definitely uses the harsh lighting and brilliant black and white photography that noir is so famous for.
But that came from Expressionism, too, and noir borrowed it from there, so it's not even really, the link is even a little shakier.
And that's true, and I think it feels expressionistic as well.
Yeah.
There's something a little different to me. For instance, the way it uses light and shadow, I think, is very, very noirish. The introduction of the Orson Welles character is a very noir kind of moment, I think. And the Welles character feels like a noir character in this story. He has that famous speech on the Ferris wheel about how everyone down beneath him looks like ants, and would you care if any of them dropped dead right now if I paid you, £500 for each one that dropped dead, how many would you let die? And, of course, then it finishes with his little monologue about how in Italy they had bloodshed, violence, and they produced the Renaissance and Leonardo da Vinci and Michelangelo, and they had 500 years of peace and brotherly love in Switzerland. What did it get them? The cuckoo clock. I think there's definitely some noir value systems at play. It's just that they don't ultimately triumph the way they would in a noir film. It's not bleak at all at the end.
Yeah.
A little melancholy, but not the same bleakness. We've got to pick a single thing. What is it you like about it?
Well, other than the iconic introduction of Welles that we talked about earlier, I mean, that's kind of in a class of its own. But I think in terms of the movie itself, I have to mention the sewer scenes at the end, the climactic chase there. Obviously, chase scenes in movies are not rare. But this one is very, very haunting. It's not about the adrenaline rush of chasing your prey. It's about cinematography and the lighting and everything have this really haunting look to them. And you're so disoriented. You don't know who's where, really. There's just people running down in the sewers, and they're lost. They don't really know where they're going. They just know that they're probably not going to get there. It just feels so hopeless and haunting.
It feels definitely like a rat trapped in a maze or something that's no hope.
And that's a feeling that I don't know that any other film has given me. So I'm going to have to say that.
Well, my favorite thing about it is the music, I think. I really, really love it. I really just like it as music. So, yeah, I really just like the look of it. I would like to see more expressionistic looks in crime movies. I think it works really well. I'm a huge fan, for instance, of Fritz Lang's M, which I think is a similar kind of film.
So, in conclusion, we should all go see it, and if we've already seen it, we should see it again.
Yeah, and it's available on DVD on a great Criterion disc, wonderfully restored, and some good extras, too, if you're interested in really delving into it.
Excellent.
So, Sam, remember that trivia question we had earlier?
Not at all.
Not at all. Well, I don't blame you, because the movie might be a little forgettable, though it's something of a cult classic. But we're talking about one of Orson Welles' final films, and it has an odd cast list. In addition to Welles, Eric Idle from Monty Python's in it, Leonard Nimoy from Star Trek, Robert Stack from Unsolved Mysteries, Judd Nelson, Casey Kasem. It's a strange cast of Scatman Crothers. I'm just looking at the IMDb list here. But do you have any idea what it is?
Not at all.
Not at all.
Not at all.
It's actually Transformers, the movie from 1986.
Oh, okay. So you're cheating a little bit.
A little bit, but Orson Welles plays the voice of a planet, actually, the Unicron. It's a strange movie. You haven't seen
so,
it.
So what you're saying is basically he went out just as strong as he came into this film game.
Yeah, I mean, it's every bit the equal of Citizen Kane, I'd think.
A lot of great conversation happens on our website, allmovietalk.com, so if you just download the podcast and skip the website, you're missing out on a lot of great stuff. Anyway, one of our listeners, who goes by The Fan for her nickname, posted that for the past couple of weeks, our podcast topics have been mirrored by her film history class. So when we talked about Italian neorealism, that was a topic in class the next day, and ditto when we talked about color versus black and white, and we talked a little more about that outside the website, and she said how the lecture included observations such as how black and white is more focused and less distracting. Same kind of stuff we said on the show. Well, we here at All Movie Talk would just like to give a shout out to The Fan's professor. It's a great job you're doing teaching your students all about the movies, and I'm sure tomorrow's lecture on The Third Man is just going to be great. But, maybe it's a little bit of constructive criticism. You know, you could maybe credit us in your syllabus or something. Just a thought. I mean, it's only fair, right? That's it for this week. Next Tuesday we'll have a new episode, but in the meantime, check out our website, allmovietalk.com, which is updated more regularly, and there are a lot of interesting discussions going on there about movies and also some other movie-related resources. Also check out rinkworks.com. There will be a link to that on All Movie Talk as well. There's a bunch of movie-related features there to look at.
You know, I actually know the guy who runs that Rinkworks site.
Do you?
Yeah, he's...
Can you introduce me sometime? Because I've been a fan for, like, years. I mean, it must have been 10 years by now.
Huh. Yeah, I don't know. I'm not really a big fan of his, to tell you the truth.
Okay.
What I am a big fan of is our next episode coming next Tuesday, and it is a very special Halloween episode. But we're going to try and not do the usual Halloween thing where we just list some famous scary movies, take a little bit of a different tact, and we're going to talk about some horror movies where what's scary is what you haven't seen. We're also going to do another controversial take about the movie The Village, continue to talk about James Bond, and have some more great stuff. So be sure to check back in next Tuesday on Halloween.
Cut.